I think we're 3 minutes past seven. I think we can roll. I like how you're all on the left side. We thought I'm going to speak to the left side here of the synagogue, because that's fine through the roof. That's fine with you. You all got your sources at the back. There's two sources today. Let's just go through them so you'll see exactly what we have. So first of all, we have this. Here you can see this colorful diagram. We're going to talk about it in a minute. Don't worry, I'm going to explain everything on it. And our regular booklet sources, pre-Holocaust Jewish theology, existentialism, and nationalism. Very long words and very complicated words. I'll try to make this class as simple as possible. I'll try to do my best. I can't promise that I will succeed, but I'll try to do my best. So first of all, hello. Shalom. Thank you for coming in person. Thank you for those who are in Zoom. Welcome to the fifth class of Introduction to Jewish Philosophy. Originally, it was supposed to be fifth-part series. We're going to have it probably six-part series because we added a bonus, an additional class. Last class was about Hasidut, the Hasidism, and today we're going to do something totally different. If the first class was us talking, discussing about whether we can ask questions in our faith and whether we can even question God, question our existence, question our values. And the second class was talking about the rationalists in Judaism. We talked about the Rambam. We talked about what we call the Spanish school of thought of Jewish, the Spanish Jewry of philosophy and thought. We moved to talk about Kabbalah, about Hasidut, about the supernatural, some say superficial, ideas in Judaism. And today we're going to do something totally, totally different. We're going to move all the way forward to the 19th, 20th century, where I would like to focus on a very, I think, challenging but important question. And this is, what happened to Jewish thought and Jewish philosophy following the Holocaust? What impact did the Holocaust, the Shoah, had on Jewish philosophy and Jewish thought? It's a very challenging topic, not necessarily challenging intellectually, but challenging mentally, because it's one of my rabbis in yeshiva used to say that the Shoah, the Holocaust, is not something you can even talk about. It's beyond words. It's beyond words. It's beyond experience. That's why he was very much against having the trips, the journeys for Poland and stuff like that. He thought it was very industrial and trying to simplify the catastrophe. I think I personally respectfully disagree, but he did say something that I do agree with, and that the Holocaust is beyond words. So I'm going to sin today, and I will try to express the change, the transition that happened within the Shoah. I might not finish today, and I'm already thinking that it's going to be two parts of a class. Today I want to focus on Jewish thought before the Holocaust and what happened in the Holocaust that changed this school of thought. And next week we're going to move into the what is called the postmodernism, which is the postmodernism school of thought, which is the school of thought post Holocaust and post Shoah. I will resend. I see there here Moshe is here. I will send again the sources. Yes, David.
The clock is going forward on Sunday, I
believe. The what?
The clock's forward on Sunday.
If the clock goes forward on Sunday, I will send that. We're probably going to do it in 7:30 or 8. Yes. Next week's Wednesday is Purim. You don't want to be here on Purim for my class? I don't want to. Yeah, you're right. That's Wednesday. That's Purim. We'll figure out if to make it on Tuesday evening or to postpone it in another week. Are you all good on Tuesday? Yeah, probably. Yeah, we'll see. Okay, we'll see. We'll see what we're going to do. Tuesday or Wednesday, we're going to see what we're going to do. And probably it's not going to be 7 p.m., all right? It's going to be a little bit later. I think 7:30 would be fine. We're going to roll then.
Maybe the class would be better on Purim.
Maybe the class is going to be better on Purim. Maybe so, Moshe. Maybe so. Depends how much wine I'm going to drink before. Scotches or wine. I was a wine guy before I came to Toronto. Now I'm a Scotch guy. You can't resist the change. If you're talking about changes in theology, then the school of wine becomes the school of Scotch. So I want to focus on two schools of thought. I'm calling it school of thought because it's not necessarily a Jewish school of thought. It's a general philosophical school of thought that was present, as I would say, even that was I think spread out throughout the every niche field of philosophy you can think of before the Shoah. And this is the existentialism. I'm sorry if I'm not saying it correct. In Hebrew, it's existentialisti. I'll try to say it in Hebrew, all right? Maybe I mispronounced it for some reason. And nationalism. All right, two things I want to focus on today and try to explain where is the Jewish thought, where is the Jewish philosophy comes into those by focusing on several very important Jewish thinkers and try to open a window, a small window to their thought. We're not going to cover everything in this class, but to give a small glance, small taste of their philosophy, of their thought. I'm talking about Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, all right? If that name tells you something, if not, we're going to talk about it. I'm talking about Rabbi Avraham HaKohen Cook, Rabbi Cook. And I'm talking about other Jewish thinkers such as Immanuel Levinas, a French thinker. I'm talking about Viktor Frankl, the Auschwitz survivor, the Austrian Auschwitz survivor. I received an email from someone, I don't know if I can say, that he asked me why I'm not going to talk about Heschel and the Rabbi Milubavitch. So for two reasons. I'm not going to talk about the Rabbi Milubavitch because we did it last time. very much. Okay, if you have questions about the Rabbi Milubavitch, I can. Of course, his influence was amazing. Like was tremendous in Jewish thought of the times before or after the Shoah. Okay. But I'm not going to focus about him today. And I'm not going to focus about Heschel either because Heschel's, in my opinion, I'm talking about Abraham Joshua Heschel, yeah? His philosophy in general, his Ashkafa, wasn't impacting, I would say, the school of thought, but his writing and his philosophy was within borders and boundaries of things that already existed, and he kind of echoed something that people said before him, but in a better way, in a more understandable way. But he didn't really. I don't find him as a groundbreaking thinker as I find. I think Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Cook in that sense. You might disagree. That's fine. I just wanted to make this clear before we start. So, 1 second. If you can mute yourself, guys, on Zoom, it's going to be wonderful. So we can going to roll. Okay. So what is existentialism in general? What is it? Because this is not a Jewish term. Existentialism comes from the word existence, right? To exist. This, as you see, I brought you the official term, official definition of existentialism. It is a form of philosophical inquiry that explores the problem of human existence and centers on the experience of thinking, feeling, and acting. Now, you may think and you may ask, so what's new here? What's the difference? This is philosophy in general, right? Who are you? What do you feel? What is the meaning of your life? But folks, this is a real game changer in the 19th and 20th century. It's a big game changer because until then, you would not focus in philosophical questions on the individual, but you will focus on his world that he lives in. What is good? What is bad? What is moral? What is immoral? Who is God? What does he want from us? What is the universe? This is kind of the first time, not the first time, but this is the first time it became shaped into a movement, into a class of thought where actually the philosophers in general and the questions were moving from being focused on the universe and on the rules of the universe, became to be focused on the person, on the individual, on his feelings, on his actions, on his thinking, etc., etc., etc. And this school of thought is not only Jewish, as I said. There's many, 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 many philosophical thinkers that are not Jews who contributed to this movement. But one of the most, I think, profound responses to this school of thought was by Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, the American rabbi, I think most of you know his name, or even more than his name. He's very well known in America, a little bit more than he's well known in Israel. Founder of the Yitzhak Elchanan Theological Seminary in New York, which is known as the YU Ritz, right? Beit Midrash of the Yeshiva University. And he was one of the most, profound halacha post-halacha thinker in the 20th century in America. He contributed a lot to modern Orthodoxy, as it is today in America, all around America. He's a very interesting figure, and he has very interesting philosophy. And he's one of the most centered existentialist philosophers. And in order for us to understand what is Jewish existentialism, again, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with this word. But in order to understand what is this Jewish existentialism, I brought two passages from one of his most famous books, the most important philosophical books that has ever that was written in the past decades. It's called The Lonely Men of Faith, Isha Emunah Boded. In Hebrew, some of you probably read it or saw it in some. It's very much recommended. It's not easy. It's not an easy book, but it's very much recommended. And I want to read together on source number one to see how the language of Jewish philosophy was when we talk about existentialism. What exactly that means? Because this is new. Folks, for you, it might say, you know what? Okay, this is philosophy, but we need to understand this is groundbreaking back then. And Rabbi Soloveitchik writes down the role, I'm in source number one, the role of the men of faith whose religious experience is fraught with inner conflict and incongruities, who oscillates between ecstasy in God's companionship and despair when he feels abandoned by God, and who is torn asunder by the heightened contrast between self-appreciation and abnegation, has been a difficult one since the time of Abraham and Moses. Look, he's focusing on the man of faith, on the person who is believing. He's not focusing on God. He's not focusing on the universe. He's talking about you and about me. How do we feel? Who are we when we are talking about our relations to God? And he goes on and he says, it would be presumptuous of me to attempt to convert the passional, antinomic faith experience into a satisfactory and harmonious one. And he continues, the nature of the dilemma can be stated in three-word sentence. I am lonely. Now this is groundbreaking. Having an Orthodox rabbi writing down a philosophical book where he's talking about him, his experience. Now, what does he mean when he is lonely? What is he talking about? He says, he continues and he says, let me emphasize, however, that my stating I am lonely, I do not, that by stating I am lonely, I do not intend to convey to you the impression that I am alone. I, thank God, do enjoy the love and friendship of many. I meet people, talk, preach, argue, reason. I am surrounded by comrades and acquaintances, and yet companionship and friendship do not elevate the passional experience of loneliness which trails me constantly. Now, talking about your feelings, who you are, what do you feel when you speak to God? This is something that was spread out very, very, very wide before the Shoah. And why before the Shoah? What happened in the Shoah that this school of thought shrinked a little bit? I'm telling you, this school of thought shrinked. Try to think about what happened in the Shoah. We'll get to that in a minute. But it was not only Rabbi Soloveitchik. We find it in other thinkers. For example, look on Immanuel Levinas. Immanuel Levinas was a Jewish philosopher, a French Jewish philosopher who lived also after the Shoah. And he was also an existentialist. And his philosophy is not necessarily Jewish, but his philosophy is very religious. Very religious in the sense that many people can relate to, even if they're not Jewish. But I still count him as a Jewish philosopher because he is influenced by Jewish thoughts and Jewish ideas. And he says, he writes down, source number two, the concern of the other breaches concern for self. This is what I call holiness. This is what he called holiness. Our humanity consists in being able to recognize this priority of the other. It is here in the priority of the other man over me that before my admiration for creation, well before my search for the first cause of the universe, God comes to mind. Now, you don't see the Rambam saying such things. The Rambam would not tell you, you know where God is? God is in the other. God is when you see the other person, when you experience yourself and you understand, wow, I'm an individual and everyone else are different than me. This kind of language was new in the 20th century. Many, many things causes this language of philosophy to rise. I'm not going to talk about it now. But it's very important to understand that Judaism was very much influenced by it. And I think many of you, I think all of you, can try and think about themselves. Where did this meet him? Do you, I don't know, advertise with it? Do you identify with it? Can you see yourself and say, wow, wait, the lonely man of faith, the man standing in front of God, where is God? He's unreachable. We can't talk to him. We can't hear him. We need to try and see the miracles and the messages that he's sending us. We're very lonely in our faith. And you can ask yourself and actually see, do you actually empathize with such things or maybe not? Now, one of the most, I think, maybe not the most, but one of the thinkers that is very, very popular, also today, even though we're after the Holocaust, but maybe specifically because of the Holocaust, is Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl, I'm quoting him a lot in my classes. Probably you've already heard me quoting him in one class or other. Viktor Frankl was an Austrian psychoanalyst. I'm sorry, was my English. Psychoanalyst, probably. He suffered very, very, very much in the Holocaust. He was being taken from one camp to another, from one to another, one to another, until he eventually got to Auschwitz, where in order to maintain his sanity, he used to think philosophical ideas and try to imagine the books that he will write the moment he's being released from camp. And he says this actually worked for him. And in the camp, in the disaster, the catastrophe of camp, he developed what is called the, he called it the Book of Man's Search for Meaning, but it's called the psychoanalysis theory of Viktor Frankl. It's a very, very common theory in the psychology circles also until today. And what he said, I would cut it very short. It's a wonderful book to read, Man's Search for Meaning. Maybe you read it. If you have it, if you don't, I have it in Hebrew. You find it in English on Amazon. It's a must book to read. He says that, again, by focusing on myself, by focusing on the I, by focusing on my experience, on what I see, what is the meaning of life, he said, the Nazis could take everything out of me. They could take my freedom. They could take my, they could hunger. They could take my food. They could take my clothes. They could take everything that they wanted. They could even kill me if they wanted to. But one thing the Nazis can never take from me, and this is my way, my decision to respond to the things that happened to me. They can never force me to respond in the way they want me to respond. I can respond the way I want to. No one can ever take it. Now you see the language talking about the I, about the myself, what I didn't say. This is a search of meaning. He said what kept me alive in the camp was the fact that I searched for meaning all the time. I said, what is the meaning of life? I want to write a book. I want to have something I can hold to when I finish. Talking about the fact that someone has a meaning in life is actually very, very new. Now you think, wait, but the philosophers in Greek, they didn't talk about it like that. The meaning of life, when you ask someone what is the meaning of life, if you would ask 3,000 years ago, it would not be what you want to do. The answer would not be who you are. The answer would not focus on the individual. The answer would focus on the universe, would focus on God, on the creator, on the rules, on the instructions in order that you need to live your life according to. Some would say science if we're talking about the Enlightenment movement. Some would say nature if we're talking about other groups. But it would not be focused on the individual. And this is something new in the 19th, 20th century. Look what Viktor Frankl is writing down in his own words in source number 3. Viktor Frankl says, everything can be taken from a man, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. Now, something happened in the Holocaust. Because this didn't survive in the Holocaust. Now, you might relate to that, and that's fine. But many, many people don't relate to that anymore. Why? What happened? You know what? Before we move to this diagram, I think we should talk a little bit about nationalism, and then it will be even. This is existentialism. What is nationalism? Nationalism was a philosophy of nations in order, in general, to talk about who are you in a nation-wise way, right? You are a group of people. You are a nation. And you want what? You want a state, you want a country, you want land, you want rights, you want freedom, you want something. And you're a group of people that have their own common ideas. And One of the biggest thinkers in Jewish nationalism philosophy was Rav Kook. Rav Kook, we're talking about pre-Shoah time, pre-Holocaust time. We're talking about Israel back then. We're talking about the early 1900s. And Rav Kook was the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi, of Israel. He was a very important figure already back then, but also today, some would say even bigger today than he was when he was alive. And he was a groundbreaking thinker in a sense that he's the first one who said, you know what? This nation, he said, before the state of Israel was established, he said, this state that is going to be established one day, this nation that will live in this state has spiritual aspects in it, has holiness in it, has something divine in it. And he writes down not only about the nation, but also about the individual. Because Rav Kook wasn't an existentialist. He didn't talk about the person, about his willing, about his freedom and his meaning of life. He was more than that. He spoke about the nation, about the group in general. And I want to read together two passages by Rav Kook. And then we'll move to talk about what happened in the Shoah and why exactly he didn't that work. So Rav Kook writes, I just chose two passages which are very different than each other, but they have a lot of common. The first one is from Orot HaTshuva, a book by Rav Kook, edited by his son, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda. The second one is from a book called The Machshava Israeli, The Israeli Thought. Same thing, written by Rav Kook and edited by Rav Tzvi Yehuda. And he writes down in source number 3. You need to cut the head. It's not very simple, but we're gonna try to do our best. And so all of those cultural improvements through which the world leaves its state of ruin, the structures of social and financial life, which continue to be strengthened with repair of every sin and guilt, from the most severe of the severe to the fine details of the scribes and the more remote traits of piety, all of them are formed from one piece and are inseparable, and all of them go to one place. What did you understand? Do we need to read that again in order to understand, or did you understand something? Nagi? Yeah? Something? Catch something? Michael? Catch something? Anyone? Yeah? Let's try to dissemble. This is Rav Kook's language. It takes time. It's a muscle we need to in order to understand it. Again. And so, again, in Hebrew, it's not easier, I have to tell you. It's not easier in Hebrew. Some say it's English, it's easier. And so all of the cultural improvements, what is the cultural improvement? This is the different things that happened in the world back then where we lived in. We need to understand the industrial revolution, that he was one generation afterwards. He saw now trains between countries, between lands, coming back and forth. He saw nations becoming stronger. He saw experience the First World War. He experienced it, and he said, wait, look what happens now. We know, for example, that after the First World War, many airports started to be established. After the First War and the Second World War. Because things started to happen back then, and he saw, wait, look what's happening in the world. Nations are becoming stronger. There are cultural improvements in general. And some of them doesn't necessarily seem good at first glance, but actually, he will tell us in a minute, they are good behind the bad clothes or mask that is being shown on the outside. And he writes and he says again, the structures, again, the improvement, all of those, and so all of those cultural improvements through which the world leaves its state of ruin, because the world was ruined and now we repair it. The structures of social and financial life. All those structures, we're talking about social structures, financial structures, cultural structures, which continue to be strengthened because the world was starting to be repaired. You wrote it after World War One, and the world was starting to be to repair himself, to heal, with repair of every sin and guilt. Again, you see financial improvement. You see now banks are starting to evolve. You see technology starting to evolve. This has a spiritual aspect in it, says Rav Kook. It's coming to recover a sin or a guilt. From the most severe of the severe, from the biggest change you can notice, you can possibly see, to the fine details of the scribes. And the more remote traits of piety, all of them are formed from one piece. All of the changes you see in the world, even in the first glance, you don't see something spiritual. Even in the first glance, you maybe don't see as good. Rav Kook says they are all formed from one piece and are inseparable. And he quotes from the Zohar, V'chulo lechad atar salikin, and all of them go to one place. Rav Kook says, in everything in the world, it was very, very much influenced by the Hasidut, very much influenced by the Kabbalah. And he said, nationally, he said, look, look what happened in the world. How amazing it is. Look at those nations. Look at those countries. Look at this industry. Look at the technology. Things are getting better and better in the world, even if you don't see it. And everything has a spiritual cause behind it. Everything has a spiritual aspect behind it. This is what he talks about nations. Look what Rav Kook says about the individual. Try to think if it's the same thing as... What's the difference? It's compare and contrast. What we're going to read now to what we just read. In source number 4, man, says Rav Kook, is a creature of opposing ambitions and a perpetual internal war inhabits him. All of a person's work is to unify the opposites in his spirit via a general concept, which includes all in its magnitude and elevation, coming to total harmony. In other words, Rav Kook says, the individual, now he focuses on another one, the individual has many opposing ambitions inside of him. For example, what is an opposing ambition? What do you think? Think about yourself. What is an opening ambition? I can think about myself. For example, what is right to do? And what I want to do. Maybe sometimes they're not the same thing, right? Sometimes I have different ambitions inside of myself. I have, for example, one of the thing can be, I don't know, I really want to take another piece of that cake. Really, really, really want to. But I know I already ate 8 pieces of the cake and it's not good for me to eat another one. But what would I do? How can I choose my decision? What is the way, what is the criteria or what is the questions that by following them, I get to a conclusion, to a decision, what to do in this situation. And Rav Kook says, you know what? That's right. Man is complex. Man is complicated. Man has different ambitions in him. But he says, you know what? All those ambitions are actually coming to total harmony. The person needs to take all of those opposing ambitions inside within him, and he needs to try and set it in the way it's going to be harmonized. Because what you think is opposing, in the eyes of God, in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the eyes of your neshama, is not. You're actually one. There is one pure person inside. Do you agree? Yeah. I'll try to convince why this is wrong. With all the respect, I'll try to convince why it's wrong. And I think the Holocaust proved that. The biggest opponent to Rav Kook. Rav Kook was very, very controversial already back then. Very controversial. He wasn't very much accepted in the what is called Hayeshuv Hayashan. Hayeshuv Hayashan was the old settlements, the old cities, the old towns already back then in Palestina, in what was Palestina back then, and it was mainly Haredi. Mainly Haredi. They came centuries before to Israel. They lived in Israel already. There were Haredi people even hundreds of years before the establishment of the State of Israel. Some came with Zagra already. And they didn't like Rav Kook. Let's call it by that way. They didn't like Rav Kook. He was very, very ambitious. He was very different. He was very, I would say, had a lot of courage in the things that he wrote down. They didn't like him. But he was very much followed back then by the religious Zionism movement. He's called the founder of the religious Zionism movement in Israel. What's going to be in Israel? What's going to be the religious Zionism movement in Israel? He was Rosh Yeshiva of a yeshiva called Merkaz Harav. Merkaz Harav in Jerusalem is a yeshiva that he established. And he, and afterwards his son, Harav Tzvi Yehuda, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Kook, his son spread out, just like the Hasidim, we talked about the Baal Shem Tov and his students. Same thing happened with Rav Kook. Rav Kook had a son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and many other students, Harav Anazir, and Harav Neria, many students of Rav Kook and his son. And they spread out the word of the fact that the nation, look what he said, that the world has religious aspects in it. Also, Zionism is one of those cultural fixtures that you can see the spiritual point in them. There is an aspect where God tries to reveal himself to the world through the state that is going to be established or the state that was already established. Depends where you put that on the timeline. And he gained many, many, many followers. Many followers who, that was the first time they said, you know what? The state of Israel is actually holy. There's actually holiness and spirituality and divine within the state of Israel. Because back then, a state, a country would be only something official on the papers. There was a group of people, and they said, let's form a country so we can have our rights, we can defend ourselves, we can live our life as good as possible. We have something in common. It can be culture, it can be history, it can be something. But the country would be a tool, not a target, right? Not a goal. It would be a tool and equipment in order for us to live together. And Rav Kook came and said, no. In the country, in the land, there is more than that. The country for itself is an individual. It has its own meaning, even without you. Just take the land. Just take the country and look at it and live in it and see the spirituality inside of it. They don't even need you. The country for itself has divine aspects in it. And many, many people followed that. And there was a very big change in the Holocaust. And look, please, on your diagrams here, on the cultural diagrams. We'll try to go through it and explain what exactly happened in the Holocaust. Questions so far before we move on from the Zoom, from the in-person? Ruth? Okay. All good? Person? Okay. I see someone sent in the chat. Beautiful. Okay. Let's roll. What happened in the Shoah, in the Holocaust, if it's not necessarily in the Holocaust, we might say in general in World War II, all right? Not necessarily in the Holocaust. It's a lot of them is the Holocaust, but not only. The Holocaust wasn't the only thing in World War II. I call it World War II and not specifically the Holocaust. And let's go zoom out, and then we'll go back to Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik. In philosophical movement, not talking about Jewish. In general, in the philosophy faculty, in every philosophy faculty, in a university, in a college you can go to, you will ask him, what are the three main, we'll call it philosophical categories in the past 200 years? They will, probably everywhere you go, they will name three. The first one is called the premodern philosophy, school of philosophy. Second one is called modernism. And the third one is postmodernism. Now, if I ask you, who are we? You'll say, we are modern people, right? We're modern. No? You can call yourself modern in a way or another. Maybe you disagree, but I call myself a modern person. Philosophically, not culturally. Philosophically, we're not modern anymore. We're what is called in the era of postmodernism, and I'll explain in a minute what that means. Let's go a little bit to pre-modern. What is the pre-modern school of thought mean? And you see, I chose one very well-known philosopher from every generation, every era. The first one I chose, René Descartes, for example, for the pre-modern one. From the modernism, I chose our special communist Karl Marx. And I chose Jean-François Lyotard from the postmodernism. We'll talk about the differences. The pre-modern philosophy said something very special. Now, when I'm going to explain this, when I'm going to lecture this, I want you to think, everyone, each one, think with which category do you identify yourself and which category you think you say, wow, I agree with. Okay, we're going to make a test, a small test. The pre-modern philosopher said, there is, regarding truth, all right, we're talking about the questions of truth, there is one truth, and it can be reached. For example, the truth of the world is science. Science is the truth of the world. If you want to know what the world is, how was it created, what is good and what is bad, if you want to know how you should live your life, if you want to know what is valuable and what is not valuable, what is just and what is unjust, use science. For example, science will tell you everything. What is not science is nonsense. Science can prove everything. If you cannot prove something, if it's not in your intellect, it doesn't exist, and you're a fool. A person who said that is René Descartes, for example. All right, who said, use your mind as much as possible. Use your intellect as much as possible, right? Ani choshev v'shmani kayam in Hebrew. He said, I think, and therefore I exist, right? If I think, I have my logic, we talked about the rationalist. This is a very extreme form of rationalism where it says, if you cannot prove something, then probably it doesn't exist, and therefore you're probably wrong. Very, very, very wrong. In other words, there is one truth, one objective truth in the world. It is science, it is nature, it is experiments, and it can be reached by learning many, 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 many years and by developing your muscles in your brain. Very easy. This is pre-modern. The modernism, where we're talking a little bit, let's say, I'm talking about the middle of 1800s all the way until the Holocaust. This is probably where we're going to put the limits. The modernism said two things. First of all, they said the same thing as the premodernism. They said, some of them said, there is one objective truth in the world, and it can be reached. Maybe the tools are different. Maybe it's not science, college, for example, religion, for example. Jews can tell, yeah, we know that our truth is objective. We know that God exists. We know that Torah is right. We know that Halakha is correct. We know that Christianity is wrong. We know that Muslim is wrong. We know that everyone are wrong. We are right. How do you know that? Because I believe in God. This is my tools. If you don't think like that, you're probably wrong. A bracha would be for you to acknowledge that. This is a modernist claim. This is the same thing as the pre-modern, but you just change. You change what the truth is. You change the way it can be reached. It can be reached by prayer, by Limud Torah, by everything you can think of. But it's objective. It's only one truth in the world. There's no many, many truths. Only one truth. But the modernism said even another thing. And they said, there is one truth in the world. There is one objective truth in the world. But it cannot be reached. And this is something that towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, it became very popular, saying, of course God exists. Of course this is an objective truth. Of course Judaism is correct. Of course God is a truth. For sure, objectively God exists. But I have no tools to prove that to you. I just know I'm right. I know I'm right. I know this is the way you live. I know, I have no doubt in it. There's no doubt in modernism. No doubt. I have no doubt that God exists. Objectively, I know this is the truth, but I'm sorry, I have no tools to prove it. Why? Because maybe it's not here, like Descartes said. Maybe it's here, in our heart, in our feelings, in our emotions. But I know. Believe me, trust me, I know it's true. This is a modern claim. This is a modern philosophical argument. So again, modernism said, or like the pre-modernism, there is one objective truth, and it can be reached with variety of tools. Or they said, there is one truth, but I'm sorry, it cannot be reached. Only la'olam haba, in the next world, when the days of the Messiah, that we will be able to experience the world and the truth will be revealed in the world. But then something happened, folks. And this is World War II. And the world experienced catastrophes that it hasn't seen probably before in human history. And those groups, those nations, those countries who were modern, very modern. The Germans were very, very, very modern. Not only culturally modern, but also philosophically modern. Why? They were sure for 100% that they owned the truth. They said, we know the objective truth. The objective truth is that we are superior to any other nation. The objective truth is that Jews are supposed to be dead. We don't want the world with Jews. They really thought inside of them that they're doing good to the world. They really thought they were doing good to the world. But everyone else suffered. Everyone else said, this is weak and this is horrible. This is a catastrophe. But in their eyes, the average German said, good. It's actually good. This is one when philosophers ask themselves, how come a Nazi executed the command that he received, that he got from his commander? How come he pulled the trigger? That's a very challenging question. But many philosophers say, and this is a very simple answer, he thought he's doing good to his country, to the world, to his existence. He wanted to live in a better world. And he was so convinced inside of himself that this is the right thing to do in his life. So he did it. He thought there is one objective truth, and he said, I can reach it. How can you reach it? I will reach it by executing everyone else, and I will stay by myself, and the world will be a better place. This is modernism. This is pure modernism. Not only the Nazis thought like that. There are many other people. The fascists in Italy thought like that. The communists thought like that. The Maoism in China thought like that. Many groups in this time, in this generation, thought that way. They said, well, I own the objective truth. Everyone else are wrong. Everyone else is wrong. I own the objective truth, and I will make this happen. I will show the world that I am right and everyone are wrong. I will make this happen. And changes in general happened. We can define changes in two ways. One would be an active way to change, and the other one would be the passive way of change. The active way of change would be that a culture or a people or a person or a group or a family or a nation say, we need to change something, let's change it actively. And a passive way of change would be something that happened to us. It can be a tragedy, it can be a happy event, it can be anything, but we didn't even think about it. But as we look backwards in time, we see, wow, we really changed. Wow, we're not the same who we were before. And I think the change that the Holocaust or World War II caused is from the second version of the change. This is the second one. It's the passive change. It's not that people said, or nations, or groups, or Judaism, and I'll say how did it impact Judaism in a minute in the next class. But it's not that Judaism said, wait, we should think about who we are because of the Holocaust. No. Almost no rabbi or no thinker said, let's think about Judaism again after the Holocaust. No. But the changes started very, very slowly post-World War II. Very, very, very slowly, there were changes not only in Judaism, but entire general of the world. This modernism proved to be harmful. When people, when a person or a group or a nation or a country claimed that they owned the objective truth, bad things happen. And history showed that and proved that. And then the world had to overcome this problem and had to develop a new way of thinking. And this leads us to what is called in philosophy the postmodernism era. And this is what I'm saying we live in. And I want to make a small test. I will make it in the in-person and in the Zoom as well. I want to ask you several questions, and I will try to tell you to what of those three groups you belong to. We didn't talk about the postmodernism yet. We will do it in a minute. I want to ask a question. I'll ask three questions. First question is, do you think we live in a better world than 200 years ago? If you think so, if you think you live in a world, in a better world than 200 years ago, raise your hand or raise your virtual hand. Maggie, David, Harvey, Michael, I see you hesitated. Okay, so we're half and half here. We're half and half, 4 and 4. What about the Zoom? Wolf say we live in a better place. Moishi, you say we live in a better place. Only two. Interesting. Very interesting. David, why? Why do we live in a better world than 200 years ago? Technology. So you prefer living now than 200 years ago, in that sense. Next question. Interesting. Why you're very? I gave this lecture several times in the postmodernism one in the army, and every time I'm amazed by to see how divided it is. Second question is, when you need to decide between making a rational decision or an emotional decision, when your heart says one thing and your mind says another thing, with what do you decide? With your heart or with your mind? If you choose with the mind, raise your hand. I'm flattening it. It's very simple. No. Don't make it complicated. Very simple as it can be. Mind or heart? If you think mind, raise your hand. Okay. The same three? Okay. All the women are no. Okay, I have to tell you what happens here. The man raised their hands. Are you choosing the mind? The woman left your... Oh, but Meital, you said... Meital, raise your hand. Okay, we have one woman. Let's say they're going to do the heart. What about the people on Zoom? If you believe in mind, raise your hand. If you decide by mind and not by heart. No one. Everyone by heart. Wow. There are three men and four women. Wow. Okay, interesting. So most, let's say an average, I think most of the people said heart, in a sense. Very interesting. Third question. Have you ever practiced meditation, yoga, vipassana, anything Eastern activity in a sense, in that sense? So yes, you tried. Harvey, you tried. What did you try?
Several different kinds.
And how was it?
Good.
Was good?
Yeah. Not religiously connected, but spiritually connected.
Interesting. Okay, so three raise your hands. Okay, what about the Zoom? Okay, Jane tried, Ruth tried, Vanessa tried, Nathan didn't try, Wolf didn't try. Okay, half and half. Half and half in Zoom, and here we are on like 3 and 4. Okay, that's very interesting. You're very divided. Why did I ask those questions? It was very fun, but why did I ask those questions? Postmodernism. Postmodernism said after the Holocaust, after the disasters of the World War II, after that people saw that the catastrophes that can happen when someone owns a truth, the human civilization developed two ways of thinking about truth. The first one says all is true. All is true. For example, do you ever hear, maybe you yourself said or someone told you, when you argue with someone, for example, a political argument or whatever, you have your truth, I have my truth, we'll never agree with each other, that's fine, you think the way I think. when I told that to my grandmother, she became so angry. So angry because she told me, Idan, no. I am right, you are wrong. There are no two truths. No way, no such thing. But I told her, okay, I understand. Okay, this is a postmodernist. This is all is true. The other postmodernist thing would be that none is true. Nothing is truth. There is no truth in the world at all. Truth is a subjective feeling. In other words, if I say I have my truth, and Terry, you say you have your truth, and David, you have your truth, then what is truth? If it's not objective, and I can just, I can change my truth, and I can change my values like in the marketplace. I can buy new truth, I can be who I want to be. There is no basis, or there is no something that can hold this entire structure solid. But this is something that is very, very new. When I'm saying very new, I'm talking about 50, 60 years, and specifically in the last 20 years. And I have to tell you that Canada is a more postmodernist country than Israel is, all right? Canada is a very postmodernist country, way more than Israel, and I thought Israel is postmodernist. You live in a very postmodernist country. For example, if you open news and you see today, these days, again, not judging, just saying this is part of the postmodernism generation. Not judging. Someone, a woman who said, I feel I'm a man. I'm a man. I want to be treated like a man. I want people to call me in another name. I am a man because I'm saying I feel I'm a man. Now, in our world, it would be legit. It'd be kind of legit. Some would say maybe not. But in general, if you don't say it's legit, then or you're old or you're... Or you're becoming old, okay, in general. But if I, again, and if I ask my grandmother, if my grandmother looks at someone, is that a woman that says, I'm a man, I'm a male, call me, my name is something, and call me something else, she would laugh. She would laugh. And this person would be hurt, but she would laugh. Why? What happened? What happened in this generation? Because truth, identity, is not an objective thing anymore, people can just decide who they want to be. I can be what I want to be. I can do what I want to do. And I ask a question. We have 10 more minutes. That's good. I ask another question. Just to see who of you is postmodernist and who's not. Let's say you go. We all know that murder is bad. We all say, no, you should not murder. You should not kill anyone else. Let's say you go on, hypothetically, you go on a trip to Africa. And you're, to South America. And you're in the jungles. And you witness a tribe that no one ever knew about their existence, and they're about to sacrifice one of their women to their gods. And this woman wants it. She says, yes, I want to be sacrificed. Please burn me alive. She wants it. Hypothetically, let's say you have the possibility to stop it. Who of you will decide to stop this ceremony? Who? Raise your hand. If you would decide to, let's say you can stop it, you're going to be fine, don't worry, everything. You can press a button and this will be stopped. Will you press that button and stop this? She says, I want to be sacrificed. Would you stop this from happening? Let's start in person. Harvey nods yes. Michael, no, wait. Who says yes? Raise your hand. Wow. That's again half and half. Okay, this is amazing. Half and half. Half people said yes, half people said no. Let's see if you would stop it, raise your virtual hand. One, two, three. Okay, only three people. Four people? Not gonna stop it. Very interesting. Oh, I stopped the Zoom. I jumped from the Zoom. The moment it's connecting back. Why? Let's see for example. Why? Who said you're gonna stop it? Terry, why would you stop it? But she wants it.
I understand.
So, who are you to stop it? You privileged white woman from Canada. Why would you stop her?
I'm going to say to you what I told somebody last week, my Uber driver, 2 weeks ago. Okay. You're white. I said, I'm not white. The whites won't have me. I'm Jewish. You're right. You're absolutely right. So, on a selfish level,
don't forget
excuse me, Terry, we're back. Please mute yourself. We're back. I'm sorry. I just asked the question. I asked who's going to stop this tribe. I asked Terry said you would stop it. I'm going to hear why Terry said you would stop it. All right? And I see most of you said you will stop it. Okay, three of you said you will stop it. Let's see why. Yes, Terry, continue, please. Sorry.
Objectively, I'm right. But I myself could not live with myself if I just
Okay. That's how they live their life. That's what they think is good. Who? Okay, so sure, sure. So Terry says, I'm going to do it because even though I know that maybe they want to do it, I cannot live my life without intervening here and not stopping it. Who will not stop it? David, why? That's their culture. That's their values. In other words, there's no objective good or bad. We think murder is bad. They think this is not murder in their eyes. It's fine killing. And killing is not a 100% thing that is bad. Correct me if I'm wrong. Now when I'm saying like that, it's a little bit difficult.
You can kill a dog, man. So, I
mean, okay. 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 Why did I ask this question again? Why did I ask? Why is it such a very difficult question to answer? Or why are you very, very, very much split? Exactly. Exactly. In our eyes, this is bad. This is the worst thing. We will never want to do something like that. We will stop it immediately. On the other hand, we have the ability to understand the other person's side and say, wait, what I think is bad is not what he thinks is bad. Or in other words, even my truth is not objective. Even the way that I'm sure for 100% that God exists. For 100%, but I know there might be an atheist. He may be my friend in my family. He could be someone that I know. And this atheist, for 100%, he's sure, the same way that I'm sure, the same strength, that he's right. And then I will ask myself, so who am I? So if he can be right and I can be right, can we both be right? What's happening here? If killing is bad, but for them killing is good, then, and the Torah says, lo tirtzach, then what is the Torah for me? Those kind of questions are postmodern questions. And for example, in Canada, taxes, this is something I was told, I don't, maybe you know it or not, the taxes that we pay, are part of it are going to fund, in general, what is called, in Hebrew it's called Hamatat Chesed, when someone decides he wants to end his life, and he can just, there are special ways to do that. Thank you. So Canada covers it. All right? What? No, I'm thinking that Canada covers. How I call it in Hebrew? Hamatat chesed. Dying in chesed. It's not a chesed. It's just dying. It's just killing. But Canada covers it. Now, the question would be, should the government cover such a procedure for someone who wants to, in other words, to commit suicide? This is committing suicide in a very clean way. It's committing suicide. There's no other way to call it. All right? And should Canada actually fund this kind of thing? This is a postmodern question. If I'll ask my grandma, she will say, for sure no. But what happened? Why today young people, young adults, and even adults over today, some of them will support this kind of thing? What happened in the generation that we moved from this to this? That we moved from one objective, solid truth, you had your values, you know who you are, you know what you believe in. We moved to this very complicated, everyone has their own feeling, everyone has their own truth, everyone know what they want, and we got to this very complicated reason. This is what is called the postmodernism. This is the result of World War II, according to many, many, many philosophers, that we saw at the society, again, passively, not actively, passively. We saw the disasters that can happen when someone owns an objective truth or claims that he owns an objective truth, and we let go of the need to own an objective truth, and we moved from modernism to postmodernism, where truth is not objective anymore. Truth is subjective. You can choose who you want to be. You are the one who's the owner of himself. You understand that your truth is subjective. In many ways, some postmodernist philosophers called nihilism, where nihilism means, in other words, anarchy. In other words, there is no good or bad, there is no right or wrong. If everyone can just choose what is good and what is bad, then there is no good and bad in the world at all. What's?
You can't say that. Oh,
one second, Maisi. One second. I know you're going to jump. One second. I'm going to finish in 2 minutes. Hold yourself. Hold the horse. Hold your horses. Hold your horses. I'm going to finish in 2 seconds. I know you're going to have a lot to say. This is postmodernism, and this has a huge impact on everything we have. For example, I wrote down, and I'll finish with that. I wrote down in the Toronto Torah 3 weeks, a month ago, I wrote down the article. And when we talked about beauty and about the clothes of the priests, and I said that in Sukkot, a true story, I went to, I think I told some of you know this story. I went to the National Gallery in Ottawa. And it was beautiful, beautiful art, beautiful pieces of art in the first floor. It was amazing. Then we moved up to the second floor, and we entered the gallery, the exhibition called the Contemporary Arts. Contemporary Arts. What can be contemporary art? And then Pril and I walked in. The first thing we noticed was a huge circle on the wall. Three colors, red, yellow, white. That was on the wall. A huge circle with three colors, red, yellow, and white. We said, okay, that looks like, I don't know, it's a circle with three colors. And we moved back and said, okay, let's see what's going to be else. Then we saw a huge painting. I wrote it down. I can tell you because when I wrote it down, I didn't want to offend anyone. But it's something that my niece can come back from kindergarten with. That's a drawing of a cat. I think it was a cat, I think. Excuse me that I didn't understand what it was. I think it was a very ugly cat painted on the wall. And that was something that I can tell you, my niece, 4 years old niece, could come back from kindergarten with. And I would tell her, this is very beautiful. And I will throw it right away because this is awful. And inside the second floor of the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa, you can go and you can see this drawing, this painting, this art, hang up on the wall, costs $200,000. What happened to arts? What happened? Folks, this is postmodernism. The moment nothing is objective, the moment there is no truth, there is no objective value, beauty is not an objective concept anymore. Aesthetics are not objective concepts anymore. Things are changed. What you think is beautiful, the other person is not. If you think this is meaningful and this is good and this is nice, then maybe it is. This deserves a place at the wall. If you'll ask 200 years ago a museum to hang up this, I don't know how to use the word, this thing on the wall, they will laugh at you. They will think, what is wrong with you? Take this garbage out of here. But something changed, and this is the cause of World War II. And next class, Bezrat Hashem, next week, we'll see, Tuesday or 2 weeks from now, we will talk about what exactly, because we didn't finish with Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik. I want to discuss about it also next week. How did that finish? You can understand. How did World War II ended up, this existentialism, talking about your authentic person, about myself, about the fact that everything's for the good, about everything. After World War II, this doesn't exist anymore. And we'll talk about the Jewish postmodernism thinkers. On the other one hand, those who fight this postmodernism, those who say, no, this is the total evil, this is a big devil, you should not follow postmodernism, it ruins your belief, it ruins your emunah, it ruins your faith. If everything is subjective, also God is a subjective concept, and halakha is a subjective concept, and Torah, what are you going to do with it? On the other hand, there are some postmodernist Jewish thinkers who said, wait, maybe we should embrace this generation we live in. Maybe we should embrace this philosophy. Maybe we should embrace this subjectively concept of the world. And we'll see both of them, and we'll try to sum up and to wrap up everything afterwards. Thank you very much. Now I'm here to observe all the arrows you want to shoot on me. And as usually, as I say, class dismissed. Thank you.